Grant keyed off the engine, and the abrupt silence set their flesh to crawling. They heard nothing, no trill of a night bird or chirp of a cricket, not even the sigh of the wind stirring the boughs of the evergreen trees. The three people climbed out of the jeep. Kane winced at the grate of his boot soles against the tarmac.
Maybe everybody is waiting to jump out and yell surprise.
What? Why the hell would they do that?
An old pre-dark custom, a way to celebrate birthdays. It was called a surprise party.
That makes sense. Or it might under other circumstances.
The three of them began to slowly approach the door.
I'm not even sure I remember how to get into this place from the outside when the front door is locked.
I'm not sure if I do either. Have we ever had to do it before?
Oh, please.
Bridget sighed in mock exasperation and stepped to the thick metal frame. She ran her hands across its dull surface, then popped open the lid to a small square panel set at shoulder level. Reaching into it, her fingers found a small keypad, then tapped in 352. A prolonged grating sound came from the top and bottom of the huge sector. Her hand grasped a lever beneath the keypad, and she forced it down, holding it in position. For a few seconds, nothing seemed to happen, but they heard the faint groan of buried gears and the hiss of hydraulics. A slit of pale light appeared at the right edge.
Oh, so that's how you do it.
You enter 352 to enter and 253 to seal the door again. You were briefed on it the same time I was.
I forgot. Something you don't have to worry about.
It has more to do with mental discipline than a photographic memory, Kane. You know that.
The massive door began folding aside, opening like an accordion. Seeing the 20-foot-wide, vanadium-sheathed corridor gleaming beyond it, Kane felt a quick spurt of anxiety. In the half-light of approaching dusk, the open door looked like a maw, the mouth of some gigantic predator. After spending the past few days in the open, with no walls or ceiling except the trees and sky, returning to the windowless confines of Cerberus made him feel instantly claustrophobic. Bridget released the lever and stepped up to the opening, peering around the flat slab of vanadium.
See anything?
I don't know.
Despite its caliber, the gun that fired the shot had been poorly aimed. The round whipped past Bridget's right hip, missing by a foot. The bullet didn't miss the jeep, slamming into the front grille and puncturing the hot radiator. Scalding water and steam spewed out, swiftly forming a cloud in the chilly mountain air. Grant jumped first in one direction and then another, having to decide whether he wanted to risk being shot or parboiled. He braved the steam, shoulder rolling through it and crouching on the far side of the sector. Kane and Bridget threw themselves against the exterior of the door, using the massive vanadium slabs as cover. Nothing less than an anti-tank shell could even dent it. Kane's Sin Eater sprang from its holster and slapped solidly into the palm of his hand.
Did you see anybody?
Short of breath due to astonishment, Bridget could only shake her head. Holding his pistol in a double-handed grip, his left cupping his right, Kane inched toward the opening, back pressed against the metal. The jeep radiator continued to hiss and spray out steam, which he hoped might obscure his movements. Reaching the edge of the opening, Kane crouched, inhaled a deep breath, and then went over the threshold, half in and half out of the redoubt. Index finger hovering over the Sin-Eater's trigger stud, his eyes scanned the semi-darkness of the corridor for a target. He caught the faint whiff of cordite. A white blur of movement in a doorway a score of yards down the passageway caught his attention. Kane lifted the barrel of his pistol a fraction and fired. The bullet struck the wall above the doorway, right at the juncture point where a heavy support beam stretched up toward the rock roof. A spark flared and the round bounced back and forth from wall to wall with the keen whine of ricochets and the hammering clang of multiple impacts.
Freeze! Drop your weapon or I'll drop you.
A big revolver sailed from the doorway and struck the floor with a metallic clatter. It slid to the opposite wall.
Come out with your hands on your head.
A small figure in a white bodysuit stepped timidly into the corridor, hands clasped obediently atop her black-haired head. Surprised into speechlessness, Kane stared at Nora Pennick.
What the hell are you doing, Nora? It's just Bridget Grant and me.
Kane swiftly climbed to his feet. Glancing behind him, he saw Grant and Bridget peering around the edge of the door panel.
Don't worry. It was only sweet little Nora trying to blow our heads off. It was just a little overreaction.
That's for damn sure. Overreaction to what?
The woman's eyes darted from Grant to Bridget to Kane. They were wet, red, and puffy, either from weeping or lack of sleep, or both. Despite her haggard appearance, Nora Pennick looked nothing like the woman the three of them had first met on the Menetius moon base a month or so before. Then she was dirty, undernourished looking, and her long dark hair was a tangle of uncombed Medusa snarls. Since her arrival in the Cerberus Redoubt, she had been dipping into the supply of cosmetics left there by the female personnel of the installation before it had been abandoned in the days preceding the nuke cost. The white bodysuit she wore clung tightly to her trim, small-waisted figure. Her hair was coiffed, neatly trimmed, and the makeup she had applied to her face was evidently in fashion before the nuke cost. But now the mascara and eyeliner were smeared across her cheeks. Nora dabbed at her eyes. They could tell the woman teetered on the verge of hysterics, brought on by overwrought nerves and too many hours without sleep. Her lips trembling, she began to tell them that they weren't expected until the next morning, and that Lakesh had ordered the door to be sealed. As they waited to hear the reason for all this, a group of four people in white bodysuits emerged at a trot from around a corner. They held SA-80 subguns across their chests and took up positions in a half-circle facing Kane and company. Two of them were recent Moonbase immigrants, neither of whom Kane, Grant, or Bridget knew. The other two were Banks and Wegman. The people gusted out noisy exhalations of relief and lowered their weapons.
"When we heard the shots, we thought..."
He broke off, glancing away in embarrassment. In his mid-30s, Wegman was no more than 5.5 feet tall and weighed in the general vicinity of 150 pounds. As such, he was the only man in Cerberus shorter and slighter of frame than Bry, but he always seemed to possess the self-confidence of someone twice his height and weight.
"Thought what?"
Banks stepped forward. He looked almost as exhausted and stressed out as Nora Penick.
"We thought it might be another incursion."
"Another incursion? What do you mean by that?"
"I mean that about 22 hours ago, Cerberus was invaded by a hostile force."
For a handful of seconds, Kane, Bridget, and Grant were too stunned to speak. Bridget recovered her emotional equilibrium first.
"A hostile force from where? Who sent it? Sam? One of the Barons?"
On the way to the infirmary, Banks provided a terse overview of the events of the night before. Kane wasn't too interested in the finer details, but Bridget seemed both shaken and enthralled by his description of McCann's energy gauntlet.
"The Silver Hand of Nuwadu? It can't be."
Banks left them at the entrance, returning to clean up and repair detail in the operations center with Wegman. Grant, Bridget, and Kane took two steps into the infirmary and came to an unsteady halt, staring with disbelieving eyes at the number of injured people lying in the beds. Kane counted 6 injured people, all of them bandaged and receiving IV drips. He glimpsed Quavell flit past the doorway of the adjoining room bearing a tray. Farrell occupied the far bed of the infirmary. He, too, had an IV drip, but he was awake, staring at the ceiling as though it were a window. He looked terribly haggard, but he forced a smile when he saw them.
"You guys missed a big game. We damn near brought the mountain down."
"Almighty God. How many casualties?"
7 dead, 6 wounded."
They turned as Reba DeFore strode into the infirmary from the corridor, pushing a wheeled cart filled with medical supplies ahead of her.
"Domi, where is she?"
"She's over here."
Grant rushed ahead of her, Bridget and Kane on his heels. For a couple of seconds, they had difficulty locating Domi. The girl's marble whiteness blended in with the stark bedsheets. An IV bag hung upside down to the left of the bed, dripping slowly into a shunt on her arm. Diagnostic scanners hummed purposefully, monitoring her heartbeat and respiration. Lividly outlined in blue and red against the bone whiteness of her skin, a network of ruptured capillaries and blood vessels spread across her forehead. Domi's sleep was fitful, and she murmured and twitched.
"Who did this to her?"
"I was told McCann himself, with that glove of his. To get Lakesh to cooperate, he tortured her."
"Looks like Lakesh cooperated a little too late. What's wrong with her?"
"I wish I knew. She's suffering from ruptured capillaries and some intracranial swelling. From what I was told, my guess is that McCann's glove emitted infrasound waves. So I can only speculate she was subjected to a point-blank dose of it. That fits in with what we know of Danann technology. We've all faced their infrasound weapons before."
Kane thought back to the harp-like instrument played by Aoife in Ireland, and a similar device Sindri had claimed he had found on Mars, a relic of the Tuatha De Danann. The infrasound wands, wielded by the hybrids in the Archuleta Mesa installation and in Area 51, converted electricity to ultra-high sound frequencies by a miniature maser. The Danann harp had been described as producing energy forms with balanced gaps between the upper and lower energy frequencies. Sindri had explained that if the radiation within particular frequencies fell on an energized atom, like living matter, it stimulated it the same way a gong vibrated when its note was struck on a piano. harmony and disharmony, healing and death. Sindri had gone on to describe scientific precedents cloaked by myth and legend, such as the Ark of the Covenant bringing down the walls of Jericho when the Israelites gave a great shout. He'd claimed the walls were bombarded and weakened by amplified sound waves of the right frequency transmitted from the Ark. Sindri also cited Merlin, who was reputed to be of Haftanan blood, and had danced the megaliths of Stonehenge into place by his music.
The frequency between 7 and 8 hertz can rupture internal organs. 7 hertz is the average frequency of the brain's alpha rhythms, so it can trigger epileptic seizures.
Both Kane and Grant knew Bridget's clinical attitude masked a sharp anxiety about Domi's welfare. They knew her mind could function in a balanced matrix between horror and analysis.
What treatment are you giving her?
What you see. An IV drip to keep her hydrated. I'm monitoring her heart rate and blood pressure. I haven't given her an EEG yet, so I don't know if there's any brain damage.
And why haven't you?
I'm a little overworked and a lot understaffed, if you haven't noticed. Domi may be comatose, but she can breathe on her own and doesn't require constant care, which is more than I can say for some of our gunshot victims and burn trauma patients out there.
Grant blinked and his stern expression softened, some of his confrontational energy ebbing.
I'm sorry. You're doing the best you can. You always do. We should have been here. Maybe it wouldn't have happened.
Quavel spoke up as she walked to the opposite side of Domi's bed.
Or you could have only been additions to the casualty list. None of you has any reason to feel guilt.
I don't. But I'm feeling an awful lot like I should finish the job I started with McCann. I'll be in operations.
He spun on a heel, stalking out of the room. None of them was surprised by Kane's abrupt departure. Kane never stayed in Quavel's presence longer than he absolutely had to, and he made it a priority to make sure even that time period never exceeded a minute, if possible. Bridget knew Kane did indeed feel responsible for not ending the threat of McCann when the opportunity had presented itself. He had suggested it, but had been overruled by Lakish and Bridget, who'd felt McCann might serve as a valuable source of information about the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann.
Quavel, are you sure you should be exerting yourself in your condition?
I can only know that by the level of exertion. So far, despite a nagging pain in my lower back, I'm experiencing no ill effects.
You've been a great help, Quavel. I couldn't have done this without you.
It was a task that needed doing, and so I welcomed the chance, as some of you have phrased it, to pull my freight around here. Besides, I have a little experience in such matters.
They realized Quavel was making an oblique reference to the incident when Kane, Bridget, Domi, and Grant had inadvertently destroyed the baronial medical facility beneath the Archuleta Mesa in New Mexico. The barons depended on the facility to bolster their immune systems. Once a year, the oligarchy traveled to the installation for medical treatments. They received fresh transfusions of blood and a regimen of biochemical genetic therapy designed to strengthen their autoimmune systems, thus granting them another year of life and power. Grant knew the six-leveled facility in New Mexico had originally been constructed to house two main divisions of the totality concept, over Project Whisper and over Project Excalibur. One dealt with finding new pathways across space and time. The other was exclusively involved in creating new forms of life. According to Lakesh, after the institution of the Unification Program, only Excalibur's biological section was revived to maintain the lives of the barons and to grow new hybrids. Although all the hybrids were extremely long-lived, cellular and metabolic deterioration was part and parcel of what they were, hybrids of human and Archon DNA. The treatments involved infusions of human genetic material, and the barons relied upon an aircraft to locate sources of raw material in the outlands, kill the donors, harvest their organs and tissues, and return with the merchandise, as they referred to it, to the Mesa to be processed. Quavel, who'd been stationed there at the time, had reported that the destruction of the Archuleta Mesa had done more than smash the barons' ability to sustain their lives. It had also taken away their future by destroying the incubation chambers. Only 23 infants remained out of 2,000. The war between old and new human, Quavel had declared, was over. The old humans had won simply by killing the babies of the new humans.
Where's Auerbach? I thought he was your assistant.
From what I hear, he didn't exactly comport himself in a way that would earn him medals for bravery. So he was assigned to burial detail, attending to the dead. Did you see the weapon McCann used on Domi?
No, I was in a section of the redoubt sealed off from the command center.
From the description of the effects, it sounds like an infrasound weapon, like the wands you people used in the Archuleta Mesa.
Quavel's small mouth twitched at the mention of the mesa.
It does indeed. But I have never heard of an acoustic weapon in the form of a fashion accessory. Directing infrasound is difficult because of the long wavelength produced. If the weapon is activated by the person holding it, protecting them from the sonic backsplash would be a very chancy undertaking.
I just want an idea of what we're dealing with here.
He took a long, final look at Domi and turned away.
What the hell did McCann want with the interfacer?
Mirror symmetry? What the hell does that mean?
Phil Boyd straightened from beneath the Master Ops console and sighed in exasperation.
How the hell do I know? You asked me what I heard, and I'm telling you. For what it's worth, it seemed to mean something to McCann.
Kane put his hands on his hips and slowly surveyed the shambles of the command center. He hadn't allowed the shock he felt upon first sight of the ruins to show on his face. He struggled to control the feelings of disorientation and the overwhelming sense of being violated. It hadn't occurred to him until he saw the extent of the damage to the redoubt and its personnel how deeply he had come to regard Cerberus as his home. The Master Operations Console was one of the very few control stations still intact. The flat 4-foot VGA monitor screen had miraculously managed to come through the battle without incurring so much as a scratch. The rest of the big room hadn't been so fortunate. Only a few status lights flickered on the instrument boards, and the center itself was unsatisfactorily illuminated by a tangled netting of extension cords and naked light bulbs. People scurried to and fro, broken glass crunching underfoot, carting away destroyed consoles and computers, or trying to jury-rig the ones that had only been damaged. Many of the panels were just empty squares or rectangular holes in the console casings. Phil Boyd, Bry, and a couple of other tech heads labored to replace the unsalvageable boards with wired-together switchboxes and automated controls. Wegman stood atop a ladder, spot-welding a piece of the Mercator projection map back into place. Although the ventilation system still functioned, the odor of burned metal, cordite, and even scorched human flesh hung in the air, coating Kane's tongue with a foul tang.
Any other witnesses? What about McCann's people?
They took their own casualties with them. They're dead and wounded.
Did you know any of them?
By name, only one. A jerk named Laszlo. A couple of others I'd seen around from time to time. A scar-faced bull dyke by the name of Shade seemed to be acting as Mac's lieutenant, though I could be mistaken.
Bull dyke?
20th century slang for a macho-acting lesbo. You know, a female homosexual.
Ah. What about the cameras?
They went on the fritz as soon as McCann made his first power glove blast. Almost like they were hit by an EMP.
So the whole crew all went back to the moon? Mac, Lakesh, and the bull dyke?
Bry overheard the question and called from the Mattrans control console.
I've just finished rebooting the main gateway CPU. Once it's back online, I'll try the transit line trace program to see if we can't locate where they jumped to.
If they were going back to the moon, couldn't they have used the interfacer?
Yes. That's how we first got there, with the interfacer. The Mattrans unit on the base was down at the time.
So the vortex node coordinate on the moon is encoded in the interfacer's targeting computer and memory?
Yes. Lakesh explained all of that to you weeks ago. So if they were just going back to the moon, they wouldn't have needed the Mattrans. The fact they needed the gateway unit indicates their destination was...
someplace else?
Kane barely checked the angry impulse to backhand the supercilious astrophysicist across the face.
I'm not in the mood for your wit, Brewster.
Neither am I. We've got a lot of good people dead here, some of whom were my friends, and all of whom were my colleagues.
Due to the actions of one of your other friends or colleagues, Banks told me George Newkirk set McCann free.
Newkirk was never my friend. He hardly qualified as a colleague. But he probably did kill one of my friends when he let Mac loose. It was Eduardo's week to stand watch on Mac.
Kane glared at Phil Boyd, who, to his consternation, didn't flinch. After a moment of taking deep, calming breaths, he realized the man probably hadn't slept or even eaten since the invaders left. He was simply too tired and his nerves too frayed to be intimidated by Kane, as he might have been under normal circumstances. Kane forced a note of patience into his voice that he didn't feel.
Brewster, I need to know everything you saw and heard so we can come up with a strategy to recover both Lakesh and the interfacer. Anything, no matter how trivial, could be of enormous help.
I know that, Kane. I'm trying, but I'm so tired.
Got it!
Got what?
Bry's fingers tapped the keyboard of the computer station.
The transit line trace. I'm pulling up the program now. If they jump to a gateway that we have indexed, they'll be able to get a lock on them.
If not?
Then we're screwed. We won't be able to access the master index until the main data in-feed is repaired.
Kane walked over to stand beside the slightly built tech. He watched silently as the program came online, machine language blurring over the screen, the drive units humming purposefully.
Is the system itself working?
I've completed a level 4 diagnostic. Everything from the auto-sequence scanner to the coordinate lock shows green. It's operational.
The bright outlines of computer-generated images flashed on the screen. Three-dimensional geometric shapes, circles, spirals, and squares appeared and disappeared. The graphics were, of course, simplified representations of a hyperdimensional pathway. Actual reproductions were impossible beyond the capabilities of either human or electronic eyes to see. A broken, glowing line raced across the screen, brilliant orange against depthless black, piercing the floating shapes. It scrolled back and forth until it literally filled the monitor.
Oh no.
What?
As soon as he said it, the lines faded from the screen, replaced by the bright green words, "Destination lock achieved." In the lower left-hand corner, a rectangular window flipped through a dozen sets of numeric sequences. The words, "Cydonia Compound 1," flashed in the window.
Does the intercom still work?
Yeah, I guess so.
Have Baptiste and Grant meet me in the cafeteria in 10 minutes. Brewster, have you eaten this evening?
I had some toast this morning. Nothing since. Why do you ask?
I want you to join us, too.
I'm busy, Kane. If I don't get our uplinks back online, we'll be deaf and dumb to anyone else who might decide to come calling.
Kane knew Phil Boyd referred to the eavesdropping system Bry had established through the communications link-up with the ComSat satellite. It was the same system and same satellite used to track the subcutaneous transponder signals implanted within the Cerberus personnel. Bry had worked on the system for a long time and had managed to develop an undetectable method of patching into the wireless communications channels of all the baronies in one form or another. The success rate wasn't 100%, but he had been able to eavesdrop on a number of the vills and learn about baron-sanctioned operations in the outlands. The different frequencies were monitored on a daily basis. Without being able to tap into the channels, the combined magistrate divisions of three vills could march up the road to the redoubt, and they wouldn't realize it until they knocked at the sector.
It's going to have to wait.
Phil Boyd opened his mouth to voice an objection.
I wasn't inviting you, Brewster. This is mandatory.
What's so damn important?
You're going to help us plan our next field trip.
To where?
To Mars.
The Cerberus Redoubt had an officially designated briefing room on the third level. Big and blue-walled, it was equipped with 10 rows of theater-type chairs facing a raised speaking dais and a rear projection screen. It was built to accommodate the majority of the installation's personnel, back before the nuke cost, when military and scientific advisors visited. Since Kane's arrival in the redoubt, it had only been used once, when the entire staff had been addressed. Generally, briefings rarely involved more than a handful of people, so they were convened in the more intimate dining hall. This time, Kane chose the cafeteria for the meeting primarily because he was hungry. He knew his friends would welcome the chance to eat something other than the MREs they had subsisted on for the past 5 days. As usual, when anticipating the end of an away mission, Kane had promised to treat his palate to a real man-sized meal upon returning to the installation. And as usual, although he felt on the verge of starvation, his stomach had shrunk from eating the concentrated rations for the past few days. There was a variety of meals ready to eat available in the prepackaged rations, but as far as he was concerned, they all tasted the same, like shit. They may have contained all the minerals, vitamins, proteins, and whatever else the dietitian said humans need to keep healthy, and since they were concentrated, they didn't weigh much or take up much storage room. But all of them still had the same repulsive flavor. Now he made 4 sandwiches, thick with ham and cheese, wrapped in homemade bread, with a side dish of pickles and a pot of coffee. It was a simple meal for what he knew in advance would not be a simple briefing. Kane would have preferred a full-course dinner, but the selection of foodstuffs in the galley was limited at that hour. The personnel usually assigned to food preparation were busy with cleanup duties elsewhere in the installation. However, the cafeteria contained a secondary kitchen where people could prepare small, individual meals, as Kane did now. Kane carried the tray of sandwiches and the pot of coffee over to a corner table just as Grant, Bridget, and Filboid arrived. Filboid regarded Bridget with a look bordering on adoration. Kane understood the man's devotion, but he had little patience with it. Filboid viewed Bridget as something of an anchor in his new life on Earth. She and Filboid had faced the utter terror of contending with Enki, the last of the Dragon Kings, so he tended to look upon her as something of a security blanket. The four people sat, and for the first few minutes concentrated only on sating their hunger and gratefully drinking their cups of coffee. Access to genuine coffee was one of the inarguable benefits of living as an exile in the Redoubt. Real coffee had virtually vanished after Skydark, since all of the plantations in South and Central America had been destroyed. An unsatisfactory synthetic gruel known as Sub replaced it. Cerberus literally had tons of freeze-dried packages of the authentic article in storage, as well as sugar and powdered milk. Kane washed down his last bite of sandwich with a sip of the coffee.
Brewster here was an eyewitness to the entire assault.
An active participant, I was told.
Filboid cast his eyes down self-consciously.
Farrell was there too.
Yeah, but he's not ambulatory, and you are. Besides, Reba has him zoned out on painkillers.
Tell us everything you remember, Brewster. Step by step, minute by minute, shot by shot.
I'll try, but I don't have your gift for total recall.
Filboid began to talk. Except for inserting a question here and there, Kane, Bridget, and Grant allowed him to speak uninterrupted for the better part of 5 minutes.
It's obvious now the anomalous energy signature Bry reported was McCann's power glove. If he kept the matter stream confined to the Gateway's pattern buffer, none of this would have happened.
One thing I've learned over the last couple of years is that trying to ascribe blame after the fact doesn't accomplish anything, except to further hurt people who are already suffering because of a decision they made or didn't make.
You call that power glove the what? The silver hand of somebody?
I was thinking out loud, saying the first thing that popped into my head. But inasmuch as we already know that some mythological artifacts have their bases in reality, I might not be too far off base.
Explain.
It's tied in with McCann's people, the Tuatha Dé Danann. Nuadu was their first king when they arrived in Ireland. In fact, some traditions have it that all of the Irish are descended from him.
I think I remember some of this. Back on the moon, you told us when the Dé Danann landed in Ireland, they brought with them 4 great treasures. Nuadu's sword, Lug's terrible spear, the Dagda's cauldron, and the Stone of Fall, the Stone of Destiny.
A couple of years ago, we encountered a man who had stolen all of those artifacts and kept them in an underground vault in New London.
Filboid beamed as if he had just received a gold star from his beloved third-grade teacher.
I think I remember what you said now. The Formorians ruled Ireland when the Tuatha Dé Danann showed up, and they had a big damn battle someplace.
Right. The Dé Danann first bargained for peace and the division of Ireland with the Formorians, but they were refused. So, they met the army of the Formorians on the Plain of the Sea, near Leinster. For 4 days, groups of single combatants fought. The Dé Danann chief, Nuadu, lost his hand in battle, but the Formorian king, Bochead, was killed, and Prince Bress took his place. In a peace gesture, the Dé Danann offered the surviving Formorians 1/5 of Ireland, and they chose Connaught.
Kane and Grant exchanged surreptitious, weary glances, but neither man decided to break into Bridget's dissertation.
After losing his arm, Nuadu resigned his kingship. But Dian Kecht, physician of the Dé Danann, made him a marvelous silver hand. It could move like a real one, so it's apparent the Dé Danann had expertise in prosthetics. As a result, he was restored to kingship. When he used his so-called terrible sword in tandem with his silver hand, Nuadu was invincible.
What was so special about his sword?
Allegedly, no opponent could escape from it, and no wound inflicted by the blade could be healed. It was reputedly so dangerous that even if Nuadu pointed it at an opponent, serious injuries and sometimes death resulted.
Bridget paused, and a vertical line of concentration appeared at the bridge of her nose.
Which, now that I think about it, closely fits the description of what an infrasound weapon can do. It's possible the legend and lore of the sword and the silver hand were confused over the centuries.
Assuming the silver hand of Nuadu was also an infrasonic weapon, how did McCann end up with it?
That's easy. He probably stole it from Nuadu at the same time he tricked him out of his lands in the Boyne Valley, the tumulus of Newgrange.
That still doesn't tell us a whole lot.
Kane's thoughts flew back to what Bridget had said about McCann when they were trapped in the Devil Control Nexus on the moon. She had described McCann as a chieftain among the Tuatha De Danann, a name that meant true vigor or young sun. McCann corresponded to the Welsh mythical figure Mabon and to the British Celtic Maponos, who was identified in inscriptions with the Greek god Apollo. He was also associated with a golden harp that made irresistibly sweet music that turned enemies into allies. As such, he was the symbol of youth that denied the process of aging. Those were the legends. Cain had dealt with the vicious reality of the man. His neck muscles were still slightly sore from McCann's enthusiastic effort to choke the life out of him. Still, he knew little more about McCann's people than he had before encountering him. The historical and mythological record was more complete regarding the Danann's age-old rivals, the Anunnaki. Both races were responsible for, or guilty of, influencing most human cultures since before the dawn of recorded history. The Anunnaki were the Serpent Kings, the Dragon Lords of Mesopotamian legend. They provided the basis of much culturally diverse ancient folklore in which a godlike reptilian race figured prominently. The Anunnaki had come to Earth nearly 500,000 years ago from the planet Nibiru, a world in the solar system, but one that orbited a considerable astronomical distance away from the Sun, returning to the vicinity of Earth once every 3,600 years. Like the Danann, the Anunnaki were a highly developed race with a natural gift for organization. They viewed Earth as a vast treasure trove of natural resources upon which their technology depended. As labor was their scarcest commodity, the Anunnaki's chief scientist, Enki, set about redesigning the Earth's primitive inhabitants into models of maximized potentials. The Anunnaki remolded the indigenous protohumans, grading them at rough intellectual levels and classifying them by physique, agility, and dexterity. After much trial and error, a perfect specimen was attained and served as the template for succeeding generations. But during the creation process, monstrosities were also birthed, which gave rise to the legends of the Cyclops, the Centaur, and the Giant. The early generations of slave labor were encouraged to breed, so each successive descendant would be superior to the first. The human brain improved, and technical skills grew, along with cogent thoughts and the ability to deal with abstract concepts. After thousands of years, the human slave race rebelled against the Anunnaki, who failed to notice the expansion of cognition on the part of their servants. By the time they did, Earth had become an unprofitable enterprise. Although the Anunnaki were essentially a peaceful people, Enki's half-brother Enlil arranged for a catastrophe to destroy their labor force. The catastrophe was recorded in ancient texts and even cultural memories as the Flood. The Anunnaki departed to their home world of Nibiru, determining to wait for another 3.5 millennia before venturing forth to Earth again. As the waters slowly receded, the handful of human survivors bred and multiplied. Over the ensuing centuries, nations and empires rose and fell. It was during the Anunnaki's absence that the Tuatha De Danann arrived. A humanoid race of aristocrats, scientists, warriors, and poets, they settled in isolated Ireland. Although preferring their privacy, they taught the Gaelic tribes art, architecture, and science. The essence of Danann science stemmed from music, the controlled manipulation of sound waves, and this became recorded in legend as the music of the spheres. But much of their science was interpreted as magic by the untutored clanspeople of ancient Ireland. But both the Anunnaki and the Danann understood and to some extent manipulated the indivisibility of space and time. They eventually discovered that matter and energy could be interchangeable. The deeper the Danann probed into the minutiae of matter, the more they found energy and complexities of energy at the bottom of everything. These realizations became not only the building blocks of their technology, but also, millennia later, the entire template for Project Cerberus. After a several thousand-year-long reign by the Tuatha De Danann, a task force of Anunnaki returned to reclaim their world and their slaves. By this time, the Dragon Kings were few in number and used guile instead of force to achieve their objectives. They worked to turn humans against the Danann by filling them with jealousy and fear. Mankind became embroiled in the conflict between the two races, a conflagration that extended even to the outer planets of the solar system and became immortalized and disguised in human legends as a war in heaven. Finally, when it appeared that Earth was threatened with devastation, the war abated under terms. A pact was struck whereby the two adversaries intermingled genetic material with that of humanity's to create a new race that was to serve as a bridge between the Danann and the Anunnaki. From this pact sprang the entities later known as the Greys, the First Folk, and the Archons. The First Folk were charged by the Anunnaki and the Danann to act as custodians of humanity and to restrict their technological and cultural evolution. The Folk's forebears feared humankind's intellect would far outstrip its emotional development and lead to its destruction. The First Folk established many settlements all over Earth, spreading out from the primary center deep in the heart of Asia. The people were cast in the mold of humanity, but they were not human, as later generations would define the term. They were a branch on the mysterious tree of evolution, yet the twigs of humanity sprouted from their bough. They were a bridge, not only between the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann, but also, flowing within them, mixing with the blood of their non-human forebears, was the blood of humanity. The First Folk were mortal, though exceptionally long-lived. Like the humanity to which they were genetically connected, they loved and experienced joy and sadness. Their cities were centers of learning, and the citizens didn't suffer from want. They knew no enemies. They had no need to fight for survival. Their duty was to keep the ancient secrets of the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann alive, yet not propagate the same errors as their forebears, especially in their dealings with humankind, to whom they were inextricably bound. Humanity was still struggling to overcome a global cataclysm, the deluge brought about by Enlil, striving again for civilization. The First Folk insinuated themselves into schools, into political circles, prompting and assisting men into making the right decisions. They sought out humans of vision, humans with superior traits. They mingled their blood with them, initiated them into their secrets, advised them. During this thousand-year period, the golden age of myth, the First Folk began to feel it was blasphemous to restrict the growth of humanity. After all, they carried the blood of Homo sapiens as well. They felt it was a crime to curtail humankind's wisdom, to hide new sciences from him, to direct him away from new inventions, particularly those that would enrich the planet as a whole. The First Folk knew their forebears possessed too many weapons in their arsenals, stolen and adapted from other worlds they visited and exploited to be able to defend Earth. They didn't have the resources to fight an all-out war, but now that they had aroused Danann and Anunnaki suspicions, they had to take action. They employed an energy field called Protoplanic Force, and it demolished the lunar settlement. Enki and McCann, the Anunnaki and Danann envoys, took refuge in suspended animation canisters, stasis units. Unfortunately, there was a blowback effect, a reverse reaction the First Folk hadn't foreseen. It nearly destroyed the Earth, and certainly decimated their civilization. Shortly after the new cost, both McCann and Enki were revived by one of the first Menetius base colonists, who, for reasons no one ever discovered, decided Enki was a god and McCann a devil. The division between the two entities was passed down over the generations of the people living on the moon, and two factions arose, one following Enki and the other swearing fealty to McCann. Phil Boyd laid the blame on one of his own fellow scientists, a woman named Ceramus. In the years preceding the new cost, she served as a Menetius chief geologist and historian. She made the initial discoveries that a highly developed race had in ages past planted a colony on the moon. She continued her work even after the new cost. She had already uncovered the clues that indicated the existence of a hidden city. Ceramus and a group of followers performed excavations in the so-called wild lands, and she discovered secrets about the moon she never told anyone. She found tunnels and passages that led to the crypts of the Serpent Kings, the Anunnaki. She plundered the tombs of their dead and stole much of their technology. Ceramus claimed that a vast, lost knowledge was hidden in those catacombs, that on the moon were secrets that were old when Sumeria was new, that were ancient when the pyramids were built in Egypt. The woman lost herself completely in the ancient culture of the Anunnaki and became the sworn enemy of the Tuatha De Danann, claiming they were a race of devils, the fallen angels referred to in Genesis. Judging by his behavior, classifying McCann as demonic was not too far from the truth, despite the Danann's history of helping humankind. All the evidence indicated the Danann were a very old race, even when they established a colony on Earth at least 10,000 years ago, perhaps even before that. Even McCann claimed that Tuatha De Danann had 4 million years of accumulated history to look back on, but he had declined to expand on that history for Kane's benefit. He'd been too busy trying to kill him at the time.
One thing we do know is that the Danann established a base on Mars.
They had learned over the past couple of years that the Danann used Mars as an outpost that was decimated over a period of centuries. First during the war with the Anunnaki, and by raids staged by the Archons. In the 20th century, the remaining ruins of the base became known collectively as the Monuments of Mars, which included the Great Stone Face and the Gigantic Pyramid.
The question is to find out where on Mars McCann might have taken Lakesh. Then we might understand why he abducted him in the first place and took the interphaser.
Brigid suddenly sat up straight in her chair, eyes narrowed to slits. She inhaled a sharp breath. Kane had seen her react in a similar fashion before when a new thought or concept occurred to her.
Phil Boyd, repeat what you overheard about mirrors and symmetry.
Well, essentially, all I heard was Mac talking about the interphaser helping him to take a look in the mirror and some crap about stepping through the looking glass. Does that mean anything to you?
Lewis Carroll wrote a book in the 19th century called Through the Looking Glass. McCann could have been making a literary allusion. Is that all he said?
He claimed the interphaser was built by following scientific principles his kind gave to humanity a long time ago. Then Lakesh asked him about mirror symmetry, the mirror matter theory.
I'm starting to get this now.
I wish you'd give the rest of us an idea of what you're getting.
An idea, and a very generalized one, is about all I can give you. But I think we'd be safe if we look for Lakesh and McCann in the vicinity of the Great Pyramid of Mars.
Why?
Using the forefingers of both hands, Brigid drew a triangle in the air.
This is the shape of the interphaser, right? And what's the shape of a pyramid?
Ah, you get it? Not at all. But at least we're onto something, even if it's only rudimentary geometry.
Well, that's a lot more than I can say. I know you three have been to Mars already. That's where you first met Sindri. But what does a planet have to do with interphaser geometry and mirror matter? And just what the hell is mirror matter?
Brigid poured herself another cup of coffee.
It's a theory that garnered some attention among quantum physicists at the very tail end of the 20th century. I'm surprised you didn't hear of it.
I was on the moon at the very tail end of the 20th century, remember? I missed a lot of things, except for the newt cost. I didn't even have a pager.
Surely you've heard of dark matter.
Non-luminous matter whose exact nature is unknown, but whose presence is inferred from observing the motion of the stars and interstellar gas clouds. Strictly theoretical, more in the nature of metaphysics.
Could be. But one thing that was learned over the years is how the interactions of elementary subatomic particles display a variety of symmetries. Some of these symmetries are familiar, such as rotational symmetry and translation symmetry. That's known as parity, which basically means the laws of physics remain the same whether we're in Montana or Moscow.
And the mirror matter theory postulates that might not be the case?
Who knows? Natural symmetries are known as left-right or mirror reflection symmetry.
Meaning?
Meaning that for every fundamental microscopic process that occurs, the mirror image process should also occur. Mirror symmetry states that the mirror image process can occur and should occur with equal probability.
So what has this got to do with anything?
Essentially, it has to do with a universal connectedness. Any two particles that have once been in contact continue to influence each other no matter how far apart they move. Therefore, the entire fabric of space-time and sidereal space is multiply connected by faster-than-light interaction, like a cosmic glue.
I remember some of this now. You and Lakesh had a field day with your quantum hypothesizing and speculating after we visited the parallel casements through the shining trapezohedron.
I read your reports. They were pretty tough pills for a tried-and-true Einsteinian like me to swallow.
Brigid gave him a smile that was almost condescending.
Theories like those are among the most intellectually challenging in science. But Balaam's people, the Archons, the first folk, successfully reconciled quantum and relativistic physics ages ago. The primary subdivisions of the totality concept were built on their discoveries.
Kane said nothing, trying to dredge up the chaotic memories of the images Balaam had imparted of his people's history and its interaction with the shining trapezohedron. The survivors of the cataclysm that had decimated Balaam's people consulted the shining trapezohedron, desperate to find a solution to their tragedy within its black facets. It had showed them how to build thresholds to parallel casements.
Phil Boyd, a long time ago, both the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann used such interdimensional thresholds, created by the shining trapezohedron, because Earth was the end of a parallel axis of casements. They were still using basic principles of the MatTrans units, but expanded way beyond linear travel from place to place.
Did any of you ever come to a conclusion about what the shunning trapezohedron actually was? That is, before Kane threw the pieces of the thing off the plateau?
The tests we performed on the pieces of the stone were inconclusive. In fact, the tests yielded no results, period. Lakesh suggested that the artifact was a probability wave packet, a mathematical equation in physical form that formed an interface between our universe and others. Balaam described it as a piece of pure matter, which doesn't necessarily mean it's our universe's matter.
Which, of course, could make it a piece of dark matter.
That's very possible. Conventional wisdom had it that the fundamental laws of physics are not invariant under parity, but a few quantum physicists took a different view. Their theory of parity predicted the existence of mirror matter. Each particle is postulated to have a mirror partner with similar properties that behaves exactly as the mirror image of its partner, only it exists slightly out of phase with our dimension. This is similar to antimatter, except the mirror particles and ordinary particles only have very weak interactions. They wouldn't annihilate each other on contact.
And that would explain why they weren't detected. I think I see where you're going with this. Mirror particles could act as dark matter, and since it has properties similar to ordinary matter, you could conceivably have mirror stars, planets, theoretically even entire galaxies. Mirror stars would be invisible because they would emit mirror photons, which wouldn't interact with ordinary electrons.
Exactly.
That's all very not fascinating, but what does any of that have to do with Mars and McCann's need for the interphaser?
I haven't worked it all out yet.
But you will.
I'll do my best. So what's our plan?
Since we're making a jump into dark territory, we don't have many options available to us. The plan should be simple.
I agree, but that doesn't mean it should be simple-minded.
Let's get some rest, decide what kind of equipment we'll be taking with us, and embark in 8 hours.
8 hours? Lakesh has already been gone for nearly 24.
And if McCann decided to tear his head off, he would have done it long before now.
The mission is to retrieve both Lakesh and the interphaser. Or one or the other. We'll be making a MatTrans jump to Mars, not to another unit in a redoubt across the country, so we need to take a few more precautions than usual. And that means going in as alert and as prepared as we can possibly be.
Besides, for all we know, McCann deactivated the gateway in the Sidonia compound, and we either won't be going anywhere at all, or we'll just bounce around the entire Cerberus network as digital information for eternity.
What about the Mantis? Couldn't we fly one or two of them to Mars if all else fails?
Rooster Philboyd was an accomplished pilot of the small fleet of transatmospheric craft found on the Menetius moon base. Of Anunnaki manufacture, they were in pristine condition despite their great age. Powered by two different kinds of engines, a ramjet and solid-fuel pulse detonation air spikes, the Manta ships could fly in both a vacuum and in an atmosphere. The Manta transatmospheric plane was not an experimental craft, but an example of a technology that was mastered by a race when humanity still cowered in trees from saber-toothed tigers. Bridget, Grant, and Kane all regarded Philboyd with expressions of incredulity stamped on their faces.
Have you calculated how long it would take to get to Mars by Manta, even at its maximum speed?
No, I haven't, but it shouldn't be hard to figure out.
Figured it out, Brewster, several weeks ago. First of all, the best time to start traveling to Mars from Earth is when the two planets are at their maximum distance from each other on opposite sides of the sun. That makes Earth about 600 million kilometers away from Mars at the best of times, and another conjunction isn't due for several months. At the optimum launch window, with the Mantas using maximum thrust when they're out beyond the gravity well of Earth, the minimum transit time to Mars could be accomplished in about 195 days. 6.5 months trapped in an area not much bigger than this table is asking a little much of anybody, wouldn't you say?
And even if Lakesh was still alive when we finally got there, I imagine our muscles would be too atrophied to be much good in staging a rescue attempt.
And God only knows what the cockpits would smell like. But I guess that's of a secondary concern.
Tell me what you need from me, and I'll see what I can get together.
You're not going.
But I thought... Why did you want me to... This would be a great opportunity for me.
To get yourself killed, maybe. No, you're staying put. You've already been a big help getting the systems back up and running, and that's of equal priority.
But to actually visit Mars? It was one of the great unrealized dreams of scientists like myself.
And it became a realized nightmare for a lot of other people. We can't afford to act as your tour guide, Brewster. The three of us have been there before. We have an idea of the lay of the land and what to expect.
Sindri and his transadapts?
I'm pretty certain Sindri is still the guest of Baron Sharp. As for the transadapts...
She trailed off, glancing toward Kane and Grant with quizzical eyes. They could only shrug, indicating her guess would be as good as theirs. When construction of the secret Cydonia 1 compound on Mars began in late 1990, Earth normal gravity was maintained in the colony by using a network of synthetic gravity generators that created a field using a controlled stream of gravitons. At first, the intention was to terraform the Red Planet, but as time passed, it was found to be more convenient and expeditious to adapt the descendants of the first Martian colonists to the planet's environment. Thus was born the first generation of the gnome-like transadapts. Capable of existing in very cold temperatures and drawing oxygen from a thinner atmosphere, the load-bearing function of the spine and legs was altered, with the legs becoming a second pair of arms. The transadapts were engineered to have a relatively short lifespan, with few living past 30 years of age. The transadapts were developed in secret in the Cydonia compound. The raw genetic material used to create the first generation was provided by people taken forcibly from Earth, an ugly twist on the UFO abduction myths.
Could be that Mac and his people took care of them for you.
Wouldn't that be nice? Let's meet in the operations center at 1600 hours.
Grant left the dining hall, but he didn't go to his quarters. He knew he should have been exhausted, both from the long trip and the tension born of learning about Lakesh's abduction, but he realized he wouldn't be able to force himself to sleep. Although he had trained himself to catch sleep whenever he could so as to maintain a low sleep debt in case he had to go for long periods without it, tonight he knew he could barely nap, much less drift off into deep slumber. Entering the dispensary, he looked around for DeFore. When he didn't see her, he soft-footed into the adjoining room to Domi's bedside. Taking her tiny hand in his, he studied the girl's blank, pale face. His mind raced like an out-of-control engine, thoughts, memories, and images colliding within the walls of his skull. He had no trouble mentally conjuring up his first glimpse of her on a muddy street in Cobaltville's Tartarus pits. Her hair was held away from her piquant, hollow-cheeked face by a length of satiny cloth. She wore a t-shirt and a pair of red, high-cut shorts that showed off her pale, slim legs. Grant easily recalled how a minute after his first sight of her, she had led him, Kane, and a magistrate named Boone into an ambush. Domi had been acting under duress, put in fear of her life by the pit boss, Guana Teague. Grant was having the life crushed out of him beneath Teague's 300-plus pounds of flab when Domi expertly slit his throat. After that, Domi attached herself to Grant, viewing him as a gallant black knight who had rescued her from the shackles of Guana Teague's slavery, even though in reality quite the reverse was true. She always carried the hunting knife with the 9-inch serrated blade, which had done the deed, as something of a memento. For more than a year, Domi had made it fiercely clear that Grant was hers and hers alone, despite the fact he fought hard to make sure there was nothing but friendship between him and the girl, but he feared it was a fight he would eventually lose. He had no idea of Domi's true age. He was pushing 40 and felt twice as old. Still, he could never deny he was attracted to her youthfulness, her high spirits, and her uninhibited sexuality. But more than that, Domi had proved herself to be a tough and resourceful, if not altogether stable, partner. At one point she had saved his, Bridget's, and Kane's lives when the Cerberus Mattrans unit was sabotaged. Even being in her debt didn't make him more understanding of her or appreciate her uniqueness. He realized he had never really known her. It hadn't occurred to him they had forged a relationship deeper than he knew or cared to admit. Always before, Grant had tried to make the gap in their ages the reason he didn't want to get involved with her, sexually or otherwise. Domi had been patient and understanding for a year until she'd grown tired of waiting. In truth, Grant had deliberately maintained a distance between himself and Domi, so if either she or he died or simply went away, the vacuum wouldn't be so difficult to endure. Finally, Domi lost patience and swore Grant off forever in an angry tirade. That was the last private conversation they'd had. Her angry outburst cut him like the knife she'd turned on Guana Teague. When he remembered the recrimination in her voice, he knew he couldn't make up for anything he had done to hurt her. and he knew he had hurt Domi dreadfully when she'd spied him and Shizuka locked in a passionate embrace. Until just a couple of weeks ago, it had been Grant's intent to leave Cerberus and to live in the little island monarchy of Nuedo with Shizuka, commander of the Tigers of Heaven, particularly after the arrival of the Manetius-based personnel and the hybrid woman Quavel. If Quavel really did carry Kane's child, then the entire dynamic of the struggle against the tyranny of the Barons had changed. But after being captured and tortured by the sadistic Baron Beausoleil, Grant realized the struggle remained essentially the same. There were just new players on the field. The war itself would go on and would never end unless he took an active hand in it, regardless of his love for Shizuka and Domi's apparent devotion to Lakesh, a concept he still found a little disconcerting. However, he was in no position to make judgments or even to comment on it.
I just checked on her.
And? What are you doing for her?
All I can, which is very little.
What did you do for Bridget when she was comatose a few months ago?
Defoe reached out and brushed a lock of hair away from Domi's forehead.
About what I'm doing for her. The main difference is that I induced the coma in Bridget because of the head trauma she suffered. I'm still not sure what happened to Domi.
I see.
What are your plans?
Plans?
To rescue Lakesh.
We leave in the morning, so I'd... Wait. Something's happening.
Domi's eyelids fluttered and her eyes moved back and forth beneath the lids.
We've got rapid eye movement.
Is that good or bad?
Good. It means there's some higher brain activity going on. Stay here.
Defoe whirled away and rushed into the next room. Grant started to pull his hand away, but Domi's fingers suddenly closed tightly around it with a surprising strength. Simultaneously, her eyes flew open, wide and wild. Convulsions shook her petite form, racked her violently from head to toe. Domi dragged breath as if her lungs had been deprived of oxygen for a long time. She clawed out with her right hand, finding Grant's wrist and closing her fingers around it as if it were an anchor to life. Her crimson, glassy eyes asked a silent, beseeching question.
It's me. You're in the infirmary.
Air rasped in her throat as she tried to sit up. She managed only a flailing spasm of arms and legs. Grant held her down against the bed.
Defoe, she's conscious. She's trying to get up.
Don't let her. Put her in restraints if you have to.
Domi shivered, then relaxed on the bed, no longer struggling to rise. With a great effort, she finally managed to speak.
God! Mad God!
Reba Defoe didn't allow Domi to be questioned, inasmuch as the girl's speech was slurred and her cognitive functions severely impaired. Grant, Bridget, and Kane figured she couldn't offer intel any more helpful than that conveyed by Philboyd and the others. The three of them waited out in the infirmary proper while Defoe examined Domi. Within a few minutes, she brought them her provisional diagnosis, saying Domi was suffering from shock and nerve trauma. Although her prognosis was guarded, she couldn't foresee any reasons why Domi wouldn't make a complete recovery in time. Grant and Kane had both been on the receiving end of infrasound jolts in the past, and they knew that the effects, although painful in the extreme, were transitory.
I've given her a sedative. She's not up to eating solid food yet. She's very agitated and keeps asking for Lakesh.
What did you tell her?
I lied to her. I said he was just fine and would be in to see her tomorrow morning. Once she wakes up from a normal sleep pattern, she ought to be able to think more clearly and understand what really happened. Right now, she's still out of it.
When you tell her the truth, we'll be gone. And she might be so angry, she'll try to follow us.
None of my patients will be taking walks. Besides, she'll be suffering from vertigo and blurred vision for days to come. Even if she could see, she won't have the coordination to whistle and walk at the same time. No matter how mad she gets, she won't be going anywhere.
Defoe returned to the adjoining room.
Mad. The first thing she said was mad God.
She was obviously referring to McCann.
You think? I just wonder if she meant mad as in pissed or mad as in fused out.
You saw the pointy-eared son of a bitch decapitate Majira and then play dodgeball with her head. What do you think?
He's not a god.
No, he only thinks he is. And that makes him more dangerous than a real one, in my opinion. He's got that much more to prove.
She turned and left the infirmary. After a moment, Grant trailed after her. Kane felt too keyed up to go to his quarters and sleep, so he checked in on Farrell. He knew the man had never liked him much, due in the main to his background as a magistrate and a misunderstanding a couple of years ago in which Kane had thrown him headfirst into a wall. Now, Farrell seemed genuinely happy to see him, but Kane figured he was probably glad to have any visitors, just so he could talk about his heroic actions during the incursion. He had already heard Filboid's version of it, but he listened politely to Farrell's, a little surprised to find not much variation between the two tales.
I wish you'd been here. It might have gone down a little different, but we still gave as good as we got.
Sourly, Kane reflected that unless McCann's home was shot to pieces and an object of great value stolen from it, then Farrell was living in an optimist's dream, but he decided not to tell him that.
We've debriefed Filboid, and it sounds like you and he saw pretty much everything the other one saw in the firefight. Do you think Auerbach witnessed anything you two didn't?
Unless it was a puddle of his own piss he was squatting in, no. The bastard hid under a desk after he ran out of bullets.
Some people just aren't cut out to be warriors. Good thing we are, right?
Farrell gingerly touched his thickly bandaged and elevated leg, wincing a little as he did so.
Yeah, good thing.
Kane patted him encouragingly on the shoulder and left him.